You too. Everyone in her group.
The Vindicator, history reported daily.
the defense would kind of lapse at times.
Well, they only gave up one power play goal in the two games. So for this time, it was more that they couldn't generate the offense. And for me, what I'll remember from this season is enjoyed watching Brett Murray. He was the USHL's leading goal scorer with 41. Interesting story. He was with the Phantoms three seasons ago, left in midseason to go to Penn State. They put it in, didn't work out. And so after a year and a half at Penn State, he came back last summer and came back to the Phantoms. And he is just, he's such a man. He's so big. What the heck?
And you look at some of these Phantoms players that have rolled through over the last few years. I mean, like, for example, Scott Mayfield of the Islanders, who are just that talented, who have that kind of pedigree. You know, you could see a guy like Murphy in the NHL one day, sooner if not rather than later.
Yeah, he's a draft pick of Buffalo, if I remember right.
Yes, that sounds correct.
Buffalo. He has a scholarship to go to Miami, assuming that's where he's going to be in the fall, and then we'll see what will happen. Of course, you never know with the offers that they make. But he was fun. For the most part, injuries weren't a major factor this year, but there were some at one point or another. Two of the defensemen back from last year, Liam Dennison and Gianfranco Cassaro, were out. The fine for the Phantoms was when they traded or acquired, I forget exactly how, Jeppe Europe came here, but he blossomed into as strong as a defensive defenseman for them down the stretch as anyone. At least that's what I saw.
Yeah,
did you notice that he?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely provided a spark for them, you know, in the later lines.
So the Phantoms go down in their playoff series. But as for our local NHL teams, I'm looking at you, Pittsburgh, and you, Columbus. Starting off with the Pittsburgh Penguins, I talked about the Islanders briefly with Scott Mayfield, but the New York Islanders, a 4-0 series sweep over the Penguins. Penguins didn't really have the home ice advantage, of course. New York had the first two games on Long Island. But, you know, for the Penguins, some may have seen this coming, to kind of the end of that run where they won two Stanley Cups, they got back to the Eastern Conference Finals, and, you know, how long can that run really last, Tom? And, you know, for the Penguins, I feel like this is going to be an offseason, not just with a lot of movement, but definitely a lot of questions to at least begin.
There are many questions surrounding them, but there's also many questions as to the highest paid players that they're talking about maybe moving some of them, what you can get back for them, because their contracts are so high that I'm not sure what the return is if you're trying to find somebody to take those contracts. I mean, Kessel's name is being bandied about. Hornquist is another one that might be going.
I heard some Evgeny Malkin trade rumors already. You know, could they move him, I should say.
Rutherford is so in love with Crosby and Malkin that I would just be shocked if that happened. That doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but I would just be shocked with it, because there were some rumblings before they won the Cup in 16 and that maybe something like that, that the time that they were aging and the cost and the cap and everything. And Rutherford came in and he just stuck to his guns and kept them. So I don't know. As a Red Wings fan, what do you think?
I mean, as a Red Wings fan, you kind of saw this start happening right around like 2012 in my book, 2012, 2013, where they had that series in Nashville where they probably should have won, ended up losing in five. Mm-hmm. And kind of similar to this, you kind of expected a little more. You didn't expect to get swept in the first round.
I'm not surprised the Islanders won. I'm surprised that they won so convincingly.
Exactly.
And I credit the system that Barry Trotz, he was the head coach of the Capitals when they won the Cup last year, and he comes over and he puts in this defensive system, and they allowed the fewest goals in the league, and it carried over into the playoffs. And credit where credit is due.
If there's one thing that Barry Trotz does well, it's he's found success against the Penguins. Not necessarily winning series, but all the series that the Penguins and the Capitals, when Trotz was coaching them, they were so super competitive and so close.
Yeah.
Trotz does probably the common knowledge thing, and that's stop Sidney Crosby. Find a way to stop Sidney Crosby, and by theory, the rest of the Penguins should fall down the domino effect. And I feel like they did a good job of that this series, and that's kind of why you can never predict the sweep, but it was thought that New York was going to win this series anyway, but like you said, convincingly.
Well, the key was game three. If the Penguins could win at home, the cliche is you're never in trouble till you lose on home ice. Well, then when they lost on home ice, and then all of a sudden they were staring at a sweep, and And the last time they were swept, and it took me, I had to rack my brain to remember this, was 1972. Mm-hmm. They were swept by the Blackhawks. And that was back when there was only 14 teams in the league. And the Blackhawks were in the West with all, I think, six or seven of the expansion teams were with them. So they were definitely the dominant team for it. And they changed the format that year, so it was no longer the West versus the East winner to go. But it had been that long since the Pens had been swept. I don't think they had opened on the road in the playoffs since the first year that the Crosby-Malkin-Fleury group made the playoffs in 2007. I could be wrong. There may have been another time in there, but mm-hmm. but it seemed like that I remember that they opened on the road with. But
we can't go a hockey segment without talking about the story in the hockey world right now, and that's the Columbus Blue Jackets, who, quite honestly, odds makers, the statisticians, if you will, they didn't give Columbus a fighting chance in this series against the Tampa Bay Lightning, winners of the President's Trophy. What, 62 wins in the regular season?
Tied the record for most wins in the regular season.
And then, honestly, this could be, in modern sports history, one of the biggest collapses we've ever seen, just getting outplayed. It was game one, and they had a 3-0 lead, the Lightning did, mm-hmm. and then Columbus just put the pedal to the metal and never looked back.
It's an amazing story, but the reason nobody saw it coming is because Columbus has never won a playoff series. I think they'd been in four other times, and the best they got to was forcing six games.
Yeah, yeah. They until last year when they took a 2-0 lead against the Capitals, they'd never actually won two games. I mean, it was one of those.
They did once against the Penguins.
They did once against the Penguins. Sorry,
maybe 3 or 4 years ago or something like that. But yeah,
no one expected this type of route. And credit I think goes a lot to Sergei Bobrovsky. The Blue Jackets goaltender.
Yeah,
he played the series of his life after that first period in Game One.
That's a former Vezina winner. People forget that.
But also. Also give credit to Tortorella, because I remember after the third goal went in, I was watching, and they showed Korpisalo on the bench, like, he may lift him and go to the, the untested, compared to Bobrovsky, there's no question on that. And Tortorella stuck with it. Supposedly he didn't rip him in the locker room after that period, but instead he was just saying, some positive stuff, which he's not always known for being a positive guy, that's for certain. And they took it. They came back and stunned them. But probably the Game 2 win was the one that was the most surprising, because they usually, a team that loses at home like that comes back, their pride has been smacked and so on, and the Lightning didn't. And what I like about Columbus is they're getting scoring from all over the lineup. They're not reliant on... whereas when the Penguins are going out and Crosby didn't have a goal, Malkin had one.
It's Jake Gensel. It's got to be him,
Honestly, I forget about what Kessel had in it, but that was part of it, that you're so top-heavy reliant on those guys, and when they don't come through. But again, credit to the Islanders for that. Credit to the Blue Jackets for doing what they had to do. Going to be fun to see, especially if they play Washington again this year. That would be a fun rematch.
That could happen if they get to the East Finals.
East Finals, yeah.
Next round, they get the winner of Boston and Toronto, and that series is still yet to be decided. We ran a little fat first segment, but I think for Hockey Talk, it's well-deserved this time of the year. We're going to take a break here on Vindy Sports Live. When we come back on the other side, NFL schedules were released. The Cleveland Browns and Pittsburgh Steelers, who are they playing? When are they playing? And I think the big question that everybody wants to know is, how many primetime games did the Browns get? We'll tell you that and much more right here on Vindy Sports Live. We'll be right back.
Vindy Wheels, redesigned for print, online, and mobile with thousands of local rides. It's a no-pressure way to find your next vehicle or to sell your old one. At home or on the road, it's all local all the time. VindyWheels.com.
The Vindicator. History reported daily.
And welcome back to Vindy Sports Live here on Vindy.com and on the Vindicator's Facebook page. Corey Crisson, Tom Williams, and Dan Heiner joining you today. We're going to shift focus to the NFL. I know it's the offseason, but big news coming out yesterday with every team's NFL schedule being released, including your Cleveland Browns and your Pittsburgh Steelers. And gentlemen, I think everybody wanted to know not just when the Browns were going to be playing in primetime, but how many games would they get in primetime? And we got the answer to that yesterday. The answer to that question is 4, including their one Thursday night game, which every team gets. That's going to be against the Steelers in Week 11. The Browns, Week 2, they play the New York Jets on Monday Night Football, and that's kind of an homage to the very first Monday Night Football game, which was, of course, Browns and Jets. And then Week 3, Sunday Night Football versus the Los Angeles Rams in Cleveland, and then Monday Night Football Week 5 at San Francisco on October 7th. Guys, which one of these games, I'll start with you, Dan, stands out to you? I personally, I'm a Rams guy, so of course I'll be in full-fledged Eric Dickerson jersey yelling at the dog pound that we went to the Super Bowl last year. But anyway, your thoughts on the Browns' schedule?
You know, I think San Francisco is probably, of the primetime games, you know, going to be the one that's going to be an interesting one. The Rams, I know a lot of people are looking at the Rams. I don't give the Browns a snowball's chance in that. But the I don't. But
they might have a snowball, but maybe not a snow boulder. How about that?
No. I give them zero chance of winning that game. But I think what's fascinating is this is the NFL kind of bringing the Browns to the forefront. I think the first week or the first month of the year is going to be crucial to them. I mean, that you have a potential playoff team in Tennessee. Then you got the Jets. That should be a win. And then you got the defending NFC champs and the Rams. And then at Baltimore in Week 4. So clearly they're trying to push the Browns in the forefront. And if they can clear that, maybe go 2-2, then all of a sudden the schedule starts to lighten up a little bit.
It's worth noting that 3 of the Browns' 4 primetime games are within the first 5 weeks of the season. 3 of the first 5 weeks are in primetime. And some may think, well, the NFL is not putting much confidence in the Browns being a contender or being around late in the season. But I say, you got the hype going around the Browns right now with the moves they made in the offseason. It's not just local, it's national. I mean, you look at national NFL rankers and analysts, and they're on the Browns bandwagon seemingly. And Tom, you know, looking from the Steelers' perspective, they play the Browns in Week 11 and Week 13. So of all the talk that the Browns have had within the division, the Steelers are still kind of favored to win that division. In some regards, the Browns are, but in some regards, the Steelers also are. Some might say it's a coin flip, but I think it's really interesting that the Browns don't play any divisional opponents really until the last half of the season, and then the Steelers two of those 3 weeks there, starting Week 11.
It's a really interesting scheduling move for the NFL. The Thursday night game, so that comes after they've both played on Sunday, advantage to Cleveland because they're going to be the home team. Not that it's that much of a trip and that much of a, it's not like going out to San Francisco, for instance, when both of them are going to be doing that this year. But it is interesting. It's going to be a Thursday night, you know, and that shortened week thing. And then I'll say this for the Browns fans, it's 4 right now, but they have flex scheduling. So it is possible that something in November or December could get moved into prime time, depending on how well they're doing, and if the Steelers fall flat coming out. I mean, they're scheduled to start. They're going to start at New England, which is their kryptonite. So essentially, Tomlin's got 4 preseason games plus that game to get ready to try and win Week 2. Because
they got to win Week 1 first, which is the New England Patriots.
You think they're going to
the Steelers? I'm not going to.
They go up there. They go. I mean, assuming that Brady is healthy.
Sure.
Which is the key for it. But let's face it. Yeah. When that's been it, and it seems like we've all seen when Brady where the phantom calls come in sometimes with, you know, if somebody touches his chest, 15 yards.
Yeah.
I think it happened in the Chiefs championship game, right?
It did. Something to that extent.
That's something. I don't think there was anything really in the Super Bowl because the Rams just were, you know, what I don't know. And then that they come back and play again 2 weeks later. It's kind of exciting that they've, you know, elevated that into that series into wanting to see it that much.
It's worth noting, Dan, that five of the last seven games for the Browns are within their division. I mean, it always stacks up heavily with divisional opponents for every team later in the season, but two against the Steelers, two against the Bengals, and then the Ravens, and the two non-division opponents are the Dolphins and the Cardinals. So if we're talking about flexing the Browns, you would think it's either the other Steeler game, which I don't know if they would do that because they're already getting a national game, or if it's the Ravens Week 16.
I think it's going to be the Ravens, and this is what kind of feeds back into that talk of, well, maybe the NFL's not looking towards the Browns being a contender down the stretch. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, who are you going to put out there? I mean, a potential 1-15 Miami team against Cleveland?
Or 1-15 Cardinals
team. Or a 1-15 yeah. Cardinals team. Cincinnati, no, at best, is maybe going 3-13.
Yeah.
So there's just not a lot of national intrigue in those games. And to touch on the Steelers for a second, the key point...
I wanted to get into them, too, yes.
The key point, I think, in the Steelers season is going to be week 6 through 10. They're at the Chargers, and then they got a bye week. And then they get three straight home games against Miami, Indianapolis, and the Rams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if they can pull three out of the four there, they'll be sitting pretty going into the back half where they got some of those divisional games.
Look at the Steelers, and it's kind of top-heavy here when you really look at it. At New England versus Seattle, at San Francisco to start. You know, Seattle's a strong team this year. Not a lot of people are giving them much credit, and they just re-signed Russell Wilson, so there's going to be less of that talk and more football actually being played. At New England, me personally, I can't pick Tomlin to beat Bill Belichick. I can't do it.
No.
He hasn't done it before. He probably won't. I don't think he'll do it again. I just can't do it. At San Francisco, you know, if they have Jimmy Garoppolo healthy, that's in San Francisco, who knows what could happen is my point.
I know that a lot of people want to jump on the 49ers bandwagon, and a lot of people were doing it last year at this time when they ended up trading for Garoppolo. But, I mean, they weren't doing well with him.
They were doing okay.
They were okay. Yeah,
they were in a division with the Rams that ended up going to the Super Bowl, and then you also had
the Seahawks. Were pretty strong.
But there were a lot of people that were thinking that was going to be a wild card team, and they were not even going to come close to sniffing that. So before we start jumping.
Okay, I'll agree with that, but I don't think they were as bad as what they've been to get to this.
Oh, well, no,
know,
because
to,
they
to
were
where
wanting.
They've been, you know, getting to this point. I think they're better than that. You know, and going back to that New England game with the Steelers, I mean, whether it's week 1, week 15, week whatever, you know, it's going to be up in New England, and that's their kryptonite. They just find a way, or things just seem to happen that don't go their way there. And for the Steelers, it's always been during this run where they've been contending and in playoffs that for every year that they could not secure home field against New England in the playoffs, the Jesse James situation 2 years ago was a key element on what happened that cost them that opportunity to host that game, and it makes a difference. It just, whether it's Tomlin, whether it's the play, I don't know what it is. It just seems like that's how it works out.
And Dan, real quick, kind of to your point, I'll even go one back further. Week 5, when they got the Ravens in Pittsburgh, you know, that span from weeks 5 to 10, where they have the bye week, Baltimore, Los Angeles, Indianapolis, and the LA Rams, 4 of those teams were playoff teams last year, so... Kind of to your point here, that's a really crucial part of the Steelers' schedule. If they come out above 500, given all that might silence some of the Browns' talk and might get them more comfortable, and by that time,
ramp it up because they haven't played each other yet.
Also true.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, let's face it, the Browns can win their game. So
in
the opener.
They should.
They can win that one. The Steelers probably aren't going to win it. So at that point, you start the season, you're already looking up.
Realistically. And I'm not saying this with any bias. The Steelers realistically could start 0-2 with at New England and versus Seattle. Now, if it was in Seattle, I might say, yeah, they're going to start 0-2 because I think Seattle, Green Bay, there are certain venues in the NFL where I just would not favor the road team given any circumstance. Maybe last year in the AFC Championship, New England, because I won't bet against Brady, but personal. If it was in Seattle, I'd say, yeah, the Steelers are going to start 0-2, but 1-1, if they can find a way to get 1-1 out of New England and Seattle, I think that's a win, period.
Yeah.
That's my thinking on it.
Yeah.
San Francisco's kind of a coin flip with Jimmy G, who knows. But the Steelers have a really tough start to their season, and then double back the two games versus the Browns in 3 weeks, starting week 11. Who knows what happens there? Is that a split? Is that the Browns 2-0? Is that the Steelers 2-0? Really, anything could happen in those games. So both teams really have really intriguing points to their schedule. And, I mean, we saw common opponents, and we see opponents, you know, being released at earlier dates. But now it's, you know, travel and sleep time. And one quick thing I want to hit on before we hit the break here with the Browns is now they're getting that exposure with the national games. They're getting the primetime games. It's no longer starting at 1 o'clock 5 weeks in a row. There's an 8:20 in there. There's a Thursday night in there. There's a Sunday night and a Monday night. Their schedule's being shifted. There's a 4:25 in there, I believe. They play New England. So this isn't a constant routine they can get in where they're playing constant 1 o'clockers. They're adjusting to quite a schedule. And the NFL, I think, is kind of challenging them with the top-heavy schedule and the busy primetime schedule.
Yeah, but that's what you want.
Yeah.
You want that. You don't want to have all your games at 1 o'clock because that means that they don't think your games are all that important. This is what Cleveland fans have been, seriously, since 94, that they've been hoping, you know, would happen. You know, the 95 season started off promising, and then, you know, with what happened, and it just fell apart, and so on. I mean, it's been a long time. This is what everyone's been waiting for.
And realistically, I mean, they're going to have to be pretty gritty here because you're right. The changing in schedule is going to have, they're going to have to adapt to that. But realistically, if you want to be a playoff team, you're never going to see a 1 o'clock, you know, playoff game. It's always going to be a 4:25 or an 8 o'clock start.
Correct. See, I'm fascinated that the Steelers got 5 primetime games. I would think that with all the stuff, all the drama that's gone on in the offseason, and you lose Bell, and you trade Brown away, and the draft hasn't happened. We don't know who the replacement players are going to get, and so on and so forth. So it's way early to be whatever. But you would almost think that the NFL would look at them and not, but they obviously feel ratings wise that even if it's a circus, people are going to tune in.
And then one last point that I wanted to kind of say is if that Thursday night between the Browns and Steelers is close or interesting, they just might flex that week 13 and make it a second, you know, go around for prime time. Lots to get into over the NFL as we get into the spring and the summer when training camp starts. But for now, we're going to take a break here on Vinny Sports Live. And when we come back, the Cleveland Indians are getting their star back soon, and the Pittsburgh Pirates are pitching their way into, I guess we could say, contention. Is it early? Probably is, but their starting pitching is done real well. But we'll talk about that on the other side of the break right here on Vinny Sports Live. We'll be right back.
Vindy Wheels, redesigned for print, online, and mobile with thousands of local rides. It's a no-pressure way to find your next vehicle or to sell your old one. At home or on the road, it's all local all the time. VindyWheels.com.
Everyone in her group.
The Vindicator, history reported daily.
And welcome back to Vindy Sports Live right here on Vindy.com and on The Vindicator's Facebook page. Hey, don't forget, please share this story in this post. We would really appreciate it. And it's always available for playback on Vindy.com. Corey Christen here alongside Tom Williams and Dan Heiner, wrapping up the show here in our third segment with some baseball talk. And gentlemen, both the Indians and Pirates have taken storylines throughout the early part of the season. And I'm going to start in Cleveland because not a lot of fans had a good taste in their mouth when the season started with some of the comments that Paul Dolan made about Francisco Lindor. And we've obviously talked about that. But regarding Francisco Lindor, he obviously started the season on the IL. I have to get used to saying IL and not DL anymore. But Francisco Lindor getting some playing time in Columbus in AAA, should be back by the beginning of next week, and, you know, things might start to even out for the Tribe.
Well, I mean, they're definitely doing well. I mean, let's not pretend that, you know, that they're some type of like team that's 10 games below 500. I mean, realistically, I think it's going to be about a month or so until Lindor is back into being Frankie Lindor, you know, just because of the amount of time that he's missed. So let's not hope that he's all of a sudden going to jump in and be hitting 300 with a couple home runs a week.
Although fans would love that. Oh, yeah. And it might quiet some of them down.
Well, everybody needs to relax. They're still in the AL Central. And they didn't move to the AL East or, you know, some of the other divisions where, you know, a bad start in April, March, now that we start in March. Now that they start in March.
But it's
still the division that, I mean, of the other four teams in the division, which one scares you right now that they would jump up and run away with it? None of them.
No.
So, you know, there's time. They should make sure he's healed and ready to come back and not force it, because there's five more months to go.
Mm-hmm. Plus, they're getting Kipnis back. So it's not like they've really been playing with a collected center of their defense. So let's see how everything kind of plays out. You know, let's give it some time.
And they've done trial and error with some middle infielders that could fill in the meantime. Eric Stamens, who was sent back down to AAA. Now they called up Mike Freeman, who's been kind of a journeyman. There's guys like Yu Chang still in the minors with depth. So it's not like they have to rush Lindor back, which is a good thing, and it wasn't thought that we're going to do that anyway. But after they got swept by the Royals, some fans I saw, you know, the Twitterverse speaks, and they were wishing that he'd come back. But it's a weird – baseball's a weird game, getting swept by the Royals and then – sweeping the Mariners in Seattle. I mean, anything can realistically happen in sports.
It's April.
Yeah, it is.
It's a long way to go.
It is April. And you know what's happening in April with the Pittsburgh Pirates is their starting pitching has been red hot. I mean, red like Tom's shirt and like Tiger Woods' shirt on Sunday winning the Masters. Anyway, three starters with a sub-3 ERA as we sit right now, including the Major League leader in ERA. That's Joe Musgrove. He's 1-1 with a 0.81 ERA in four games. He's started three of them. He's thrown 22 in a third inning, so hot start for him. Chris Archer has a 2-flat ERA, and Trevor Williams with a 2.59 ERA. Good starting pitching from the Pirates has kind of brought them up in the NL Central in a really tough division, Tom.
Be interesting to see what the reaction is this week in their home against the Giants, and then honestly, I don't remember who they're playing next week, but I know they're going to be home for a while. They've been on the road. See what the reaction of the fans now that the Penguins have been eliminated. The NFL schedule is out. I mean, the Pirates are going to have the spotlight on themselves up until the draft and later on next week, and it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is. Do they turn out? You know, do you go to baseball games on Easter Sunday, or do you just watch at home from television? We'll find out. Maybe the promotion is good enough that it'll draw young families out with young children to come and be part of it.
But Dan, looking at the Pirates, they're second overall in Major League Baseball in team ERA at 2.09. So it's not just the starters. Their relievers are pitching well. I know Felipe Vasquez has been an all-star before. Certainly the Pirates like Keon Akella back there in the bullpen. Kyle Crick has come back from injury. So if the Pirates are doing well, it's probably because of their pitching.
Well, yeah, and this is one of the questions that baffled me last year was when the Pirates made some really late moves at the trade deadline. And a lot of people were kind of sitting there wondering why a team that has no realistic shot at winning the NL Central would try to acquire veteran talent. And now we're kind of seeing that. Yeah, guys like Chris Archer, they're on a cheap contract. They have multi-year control. And those kind of moves late July last year definitely are panning out for them now. Now, do they maybe end up beating teams like St. Louis and Milwaukee down the stretch? Who knows? But I think there's definitely more hope than there's been in recent years in Pittsburgh.
I'll tell you what, that Archer trade's working twofold because Tyler Glasnow's third in the majors in ERA, and Austin Meadows is having some kind of renaissance with the Rays. I think it's really happened. The Rays organization just knows how to develop talent, and it happened with Austin Meadows, and now it's happening with Yandy Diaz as they acquired him from the Indians.
One key guy would be Talon for the Pirates.
Tyon, yep.
If he can somehow end up kind of flipping that switch. He had a couple good starts last year. If he can kind of start building some momentum going into May and June, I'd be very interested to see where the Pirates are sitting in the standings.
Taillon currently 0-2 with a 3.43 ERA in four starts. So, you know, thankfully the Pirates have guys in their rotation right now that are kind of picking up that slack. But if those three can continue, and I'm not expecting Musgrove to have a sub-1 ERA the whole season, but if that flattens out to somewhere in the 2-3 range and Taillon can bring his down closer to 3, again, the Pirates could be something if this starting pitching really holds up.
They can, but they need to continue to be playing consistently. They can't get too far behind because that division with those teams that you mentioned in there, and the Cubs are in there as well, it's hard catching up once you fall behind. And that's why the next week or so is going to be interesting to see, can they keep this up, and will it carry over into May?
I mean, you look at Milwaukee has an MVP in Christian Yelich, who right now would probably repeat if there was an award for it today. Paul Goldschmidt, a former MVP in St. Louis now, and Cincinnati got better in the offseason, and the Cubs, you know, are not far from a World Series run where they still have most of those players. So, yeah, that division, the NL Central, probably the most competitive in all of baseball, if you're really looking at it. And that's saying something, given the AL East had, two postseason teams last year and another 90-game winner in Tampa Bay.
You know, in baseball, it's kind of interesting. Everybody wants to kind of do the same thing, but it's the teams that try to split themselves off from the pack that usually end up making the postseason. Look at the Indians, they got good pitching. The Pirates, they're the only team in that division that has really, at this point, amazing pitching, and that's what they're going to have to rely on because you're not going to have the bats to kind of out-muscle guys like you said, like Yelich or Goldschmidt.
Mm-hmm. And you're not likely to acquire them at the trade deadline either with what's out there, whereas other teams with much more... they have more resources that they're willing to invest in their team than probably what the Pirates are going to. So you're sort of looking at what you know. And again, Archer, the trade, that was great and a little bit unusual last year, but that's the thing, it was unusual.
If the Pirates do want to buy, and I want to wrap up here in a minute, if the Pirates do buy at the trade deadline, I know we're looking ahead and maybe wishful thinking, some would say, they do have prospects to deal. They have guys like Mitch Keller, Nick Kingham as pitchers, and Cabrian Hayes, an infielder that can play some outfield. They have guys that are in the minors. You know, Kevin Kramer I'm thinking of as well, a middle infield prospect up in AAA. There's some guys up there that other teams might be interested in. So if the Pirates really want to go for it, if they feel they're in position, like you said, Dan, we've seen them down, and they're not afraid to add. I'm curious to see if they would ever do that again.
One interesting move is San Francisco low-key tried to get rid of Belt last year at the trade deadline. He was a guy that when the Indians were having their discussions with McCutchen, kind of was starting to show up in some scouting reports. The problem is he went on the DL. It'll be interesting if San Francisco drops off and Pittsburgh can kind of hang around that 500 mark, could adding a bat that can also do some pretty good work in the field, could that be a potential trade target for them?
Well, that would create, and again, we're just kind of spitballing, but that would create a little position battle with Josh Bell. I don't know if they would platoon, but it would be a little interesting to think about.
And plus in the National League, I mean, guys are brought up. They know how to play multiple positions.
That's
so,
true.
You know, can maybe move somewhere else in the lineup or somewhere else in the defensive order, you know, kind of give them an opportunity somewhere down the line.
A final thought for you this week, Tom, as we wrap up here?
Just sad that the hockey season for the Mahoning Valley is over. I know Cleveland is playing, but you know, it would have been nice to see the Phantoms advance to the next series, maybe even the Eastern Conference final again and see. I don't think this team was anywhere near as talented as what last year's group was. It makes you appreciate what last year's group did, but it would have been fun to have some more games down at the Cavelli Center next week.
How about you, Dan?
You know, last week we touched on pitching in the high school ranks.
Yeah.
You know, Tuesday was a really interesting day. On the softball side, Poland's Ashley Wire threw a 6-inning no-hitter. She threw a no-hitter in a 13-0 win over Girard. Cooper Vance from East Palestine, yeah, since Brian's not here. Freshman makes his varsity debut,
yeah,
and strikes out 18.
Amazing.
In a 6-0 win over Latonia.
How many innings?
He went complete game,
seven innings.
So, and Jake Gehrig.
All but three outs.
Yeah. Jake Gehrig caps the night in a 16-0 win over Struthers with a perfect game, going five innings, striking out 15.
That's called the Aaron Gabriel.
Yeah, right.
That's unbelievable. Congratulations to them. You know, we've talked last week, like you said, about pitching around here. There's been no-hitters galore around here. I mean, they're at a premium. Not just no-hitters, but just solid pitching quality starts from a lot of players and a lot of teams.
That's all in one day.
Yeah. That's just Tuesday.
And that was just Tuesday.
It's an average Tuesday baseball in the Valley. My final thought, the conspiracy theories on the breakdown of the Alliance of American Football are slowly starting to bubble. And Charlie Ebersole, who originally founded the league, has addressed said conspiracy theories, the main one being that Vince McMahon and Tom Dundon, who Tom Dundon put a lot of money into the AAF, were kind of in collusion to disband the league to make room for the XFL. So I'm keeping an eye on that story as we develop. And also, Tiger won the Masters, so I'm still geeked over it, personally. But
over the AAF or over Tiger winning
both,
the Masters?
Both. I missed the AAF already. It would have been, we'd be in playoff talk right now with the AAF, which is sad to think. But thank you, those at home and those watching on their phones, on mobile, wherever you're watching. Thank you so much for tuning in to us this week. Again, we are live every Thursday at 5 p.m. from right here in the Vindicator's offices in downtown Youngstown with Vindy Sports Live. So for Tom Williams and Dan Heiner, my name is Corey Christen. We will talk to you guys next week. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
Everyone in her group.
The Vindicator. History reported daily.